KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
806-949 KUOW. A word or two before we get to Speakers Forum. We're able to go out around Seattle and record these interesting talks and present them to you largely because of listener financial support. It's the biggest single factor in our budget. We like presenting these for you. If you count on hearing Speakers Forum each Thursday evening, then please step forward and make a pledge of support. The spring pledge drive is online for the evening now. So it's quick and easy to go online and make that pledge in whatever amount suits your budget. But please, if you're in a habit of regularly listening, please pledge at KUOW.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Several third world countries have turned themselves around from hardship in the past 30 years. China rose from seemingly hopeless poverty. Mexico bounced back from the third world debt crisis. Brazil overcame hyperinflation. Economist Peter Blair Henry argues that first world countries have a lot to learn about discipline and humility from these third world successes. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19, 2013.
The three things that the first world needs to learn from the history of third world countries' struggle with economic reforms are discipline, clarity, and trust. So what I want to do, I want to briefly share with you a short passage from the book, because I think it's important as we talk about macroeconomics. It's very easy to lose track that behind numbers of GDP growth and growth rates below trend growth rate and unemployment and trade deficits and inflation, and fiscal deficits, we're talking about people. Macroeconomics matters because it affects people. So I want to share with you a short passage from the book, if I might. This passage is taken from chapter 1. Growing up as a little boy on the island of Jamaica in the early 1970s, I cherished the time I spent on the porch of my grandmother's simple two-bedroom ranch house in Kingston, the nation's capital. There, at 3 Windy Way in Harborview, a middle and working-class neighborhood at the southern edge of the city, I would sit on the brown speckled tile, leafing through the pages of Encyclopedia Britannica, reading Bible stories, and poring over back issues of National Geographic for hours on end. As sea breezes stirred the needles of the casuarina trees that lined the front yard and shaded my world from both the sun and the gazes of people passing by on the sidewalk, scents from Grandma's kitchen, pumpkin soup, baking bread, brown sugar, and lime juice wafted through the air. Things only got better as the day progressed, and the sun made its arc through the cobalt expanse of the Jamaican afternoon sky. The approach of evening was always my favorite stretch of time, a welcome pause between the heat of day and the fall of darkness. Grandma, finished with her cooking and housework, would come outside and sit with me in the early evening air. Encouraging children to read and dream was what Grandma, a former schoolteacher, did best. And she never missed an opportunity to work with one of her favorite students. Sitting together in the fading light, we lost ourselves in conversation, accompanied by the pulse of chirping crickets, the reverberating reggae beats from a nearby rum shop, and the animated voices of young men playing soccer in the street. These are the sounds of the Caribbean, the lyrical backdrop to Grandma's outdoor classroom, where I asked question after question about the people and places I had encountered in the day's reading, and my ever-patient teacher shared with me facts and figures about distant lands. Yet the greatest lesson I learned from my grandmother came not from something she read to me, but from something she did for someone else. In Jamaica, as in many developing countries, poverty is never far away. On one occasion, the ambient sounds of those Caribbean evenings gave way to the piercing call of a woman at the front gate. "Mrs. Henry, Mrs. Henry, you deso? Me beg you, make me come in. When poverty calls to you from the gate, you have to make a choice. You can avert your eyes, perhaps even turn your back and harden your resolve not to engage. But poverty will still be there looking at you, even if you don't have the courage to return its gaze. Soon come," Grandma called out, as she lifted her tiny, slightly hunched frame from the chair next to me, walked across the tiles, stepped from porch to carport, and made the 30-foot journey to the gate. "Good evening, Miss Mama. How are you?" Miss Mama's appearance belied her reply. "Me all right so far, Mrs. Henry." Miss Mama looked anything but all right to me as I watched her follow Grandma toward the porch. The closer Miss Mama came to my sacred classroom, the sharper the contrast I discerned between her and my beloved tutor. With bare feet, tattered clothes, matted hair, and a protruding belly seemingly at odds with her thin frame, Miss Mama appeared to be from an entirely different planet than my grandmother, who, with her pressed and starched cotton dress and neatly groomed appearance, was the quintessential schoolteacher and matron of the Anglican Church. After inviting Miss Mama to sit down next to her and across from me, Grandma asked Miss Mama if she was hungry. Miss Mama replied, "Yes, Mrs. Henry. Is long time me not eat, you know, ma'am." My grandmother disappeared inside, then emerged a few minutes later with a large tumbler of milk and a plate of warm, hard dough bread dripping with butter. I sat there, watching Miss Mama eat and listening to the exchange. My grandmother asking questions in the Queen's English, Miss Mama responding in patois. They continued on for some time, Miss Mama chronicling her tough circumstances, my grandmother offering words of comfort and encouragement, until the last crumbs disappeared from the plate, the milk was drained, and my grandmother sent Miss Mama on her way with a familiar Jamaican benediction. "Walk good." I don't know how Miss Mama got her name, and I don't know where she came from, but I can picture her today just as I saw her in that first encounter in late 1977 when I was 8 years old. Over the next several months, Miss Mama appeared at my grandmother's front gate with increasing frequency. One day in 1978, following what turned out to be the last time I saw Miss Mama, I asked my grandmother, "Grandma, Miss Mama has a big belly, so why is she always hungry?" My grandmother replied that some people have big bellies, not from eating too much, but because they never get enough to eat. For me, economics is all about Miss Mama. I was drawn to the subject because I wanted to help people in developing countries, like my native Jamaica, help themselves. Feeding the hungry is an act of kindness. Providing the hungry with the means to feed themselves is an act of empowerment that confers dignity as well as nourishment. My grandmother was too old and lacked the technical training to give people like Miss Mama that kind of enabling assistance. I wrote this book because I have no such excuse. Helping people to help themselves begins with a simple observation. Never in the history of the world has a country sustainably reduced poverty without significantly increasing its population's average overall standard of living. The gains from economic expansion may not be evenly distributed, so growth alone is not a sufficient condition for development. But it is absolutely necessary. Without growth, life becomes a series of zero-sum struggles directed at preserving one's share of limited resources. With growth, the pie expands and the politics of distribution no longer involve such stark trade-offs. Because economic expansion provides the most reliable means of enabling the poor to lift themselves out of poverty, the critical question is, what kinds of economic policies lay the foundations for growth? The economic policy decisions implemented in the months and years ahead will determine whether people eat or starve, live or die, and not just in emerging economies. The financial crisis of 2008-2009 drove record numbers of people in the United States into unemployment, foreclosure, and poverty, to say nothing of the devastating impact of its aftershocks on the economies and people of Europe. Whether in the first world or the third, there's no place to hide from the power of policy. So there are lots of Miss Mamas outside of Jamaica. There are plenty of people for whom the stakes ahead are high. And it's in that context that I want to round out our conversation. So I talked about three things: discipline, clarity, and trust, that the advanced nations need to learn from the third world in order to move forward. And to illustrate the point of what discipline means, I said discipline doesn't mean austerity. It's useful to remind ourselves that there's a very difficult debate going on right now between fiscal austerity and stimulus. But it's important to remind ourselves that debate didn't begin in the United States in the course of the last year or so. It didn't begin with the debt ceiling debate in 2011. The debate over what discipline means, and I want to talk now specifically about the context of fiscal policy, began at least as early as 1985. So I mentioned in the reading that Miss Mama began appearing at my grandmother's gate with increasing frequency in 1978. Well, in 1978, what was happening? Third world nations were borrowing very heavily from banks in the United States and Western Europe. And they were about to fall into what's known as the 1982 debt crisis. Overborrowing and ineffective use of that borrowing led to Mexico first defaulting on its debt in 1982, and then a series of countries realizing they couldn't pay their debts. And Jamaica was in the midst of that same cycle and was experiencing a dramatic economic downturn. And so in October of 1985, with the world financial system in serious trouble, because countries like Brazil, Mexico, big third world countries had borrowed large amounts of debt from Western banks. James A. Baker III, former Secretary of the Treasury, goes to Seoul, South Korea, on behalf of his boss, President Ronald Reagan, and makes a speech. He makes a speech at the World Bank IMF meetings in Seoul, South Korea, titled Program for Sustained Growth. This program for sustained growth is Baker's vision, the United States' vision, the World Bank's vision, the IMF's vision, the International Monetary Fund's vision, of what third world nations needed to do to start growing. And Baker goes through in his speech a list of items, chief of which was fiscal discipline, what it means to have sound fiscal policy. He also talked about trade policy and the need for greater openness to flows of goods and services, the role of foreign direct investment, the role of the state, and so on and so forth. And so here is the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States laying out a program for sustained growth for the third world. And to put it mildly, because you have to understand the historical context here, Baker's preaching, teaching countries that have just, in many cases, come out of a colonial history not too much earlier, and are asserting themselves, asserting their independence, right? In the case of Jamaica, independence in 1962, and are now being told by the United States, and implicitly by other Western powers as well, former colonial masters, what they need to do to get their house in order. So Baker's speech, to put it mildly, was not well received in the developing world. And it set off a firestorm of criticism and a firestorm of debate about what discipline actually means. And so the question then becomes, is discipline what Baker said it was in his speech, in the quote-unquote Washington consensus? Or does it mean something else? How do we know what discipline policy looks like? And so one of the things that I've endeavored to do in this book is to say, how do we get past ideology? How do we understand not what Baker thought about or thinks about what good economic policy looks like, and not what, pick your favorite person on the left, whether it be Joe Stiglitz, or on the right, pick another economist, Ann Kruger, former deputy managing director, first deputy managing director of the IMF. In the book, I argue that what we need to do is not ask where political proclivities lie, but ask, what creates value? When countries in the past have made decisions to implement some subset of the list of market-friendly policies that Baker outlined in his speech, does it create or destroy value on average in these countries? And in particular, I point out in the book that we have a really useful barometer for actually answering that question. It turns out, looking at how the stock market in these countries responds when governments announce these major policy changes, provides as good a forecast as to whether these changes are going to actually create value by creating investment and growth than just about anything else.
Peter Blair Henry, an economist and the author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drew has recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Peter Blair Henry in a moment. 823, 94.9 KUOW. Daniel Goleman, a former New York Times science reporter, talks about his book Emotional Intelligence, which describes emerging brain research that shows the superior functioning of people who develop skills of self-awareness and the ability to regulate their emotions. He also talks about his subsequent book, Social Intelligence, which looks into the brain chemistry of how people interact with each other. It's all tonight at 10:30 on Humankind. Bliss for the ear for fans of news and information, and it requires your pledge at kuow.org. You can take care of that right now before we get back to, or fully back to, Speakers Forum and Peter Blair Henry. It's easy, quick. We're nearing the end of the drive. Let's go out in style with your pledge at kuow.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. First world countries have a lot to learn from third world countries. That's according to Peter Blair Henry, an economist and dean of NYU's business school. Henry argues that third world nations have overcome tremendous obstacles, and the secret to their success is something the first world should adapt. Henry's new book is called Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19th, 2013.
I want to tell you a specific story about what discipline means. So discipline in the context of fiscal policy, and the book talks about discipline in the context of international trade, and many other things. But let's talk about fiscal policy right now, since that's been such a focus of discussion in the United States and Europe. Fiscal discipline is no more complicated than the story of the ant and the grasshopper in Aesop's fable. Fiscal discipline means when times are good, and I mentioned that period of 2002 to 2007 earlier, when times are good, you run surpluses and you save, so that when times are bad, you have a cushion. Example, the United States. In 2001, we had a record fiscal surplus of $236 billion. We also had a surplus in 2000. It wasn't quite as big, but it was also on the order of $200 billion. From 2002 to 2007, and ever since, we've run deficits. We decided to give that fiscal surplus back in the form of tax cuts. Contrast the first world grasshopper with the third world ant of Chile. Chile experienced a boom in the 2000s. The price of copper, along with many other commodities, rose really dramatically during that period because of this booming period of global growth that I talked about, being fueled by emerging markets. The Chilean treasury experienced dramatic inflows in revenues, and in 2008, the people of Chile took to the streets and burned in effigy Andrés Velasco, the finance minister of the country, saying, "Give us the money." Right? Give the money back to the people. Andrés Velasco said, "No. This money's for a rainy day." The financial crisis hits. Two very different stories. Chile is able to implement a $4 billion tax cut to cushion the economy, to provide fiscal stimulus when it's needed. We know the story that happened here. We've been running deficits for years up until that point, and so it just added to our deficit. So fiscal discipline means nothing more complicated than the ant and the grasshopper. And let's generalize from the stories of Chile and the United States to the first world and third world more generally. From 2002 to 2007, during that boom period, advanced nations were all running, on average, fiscal deficits, about 3% of GDP. Emerging economies, you guessed it, surplus is about 1% of GDP. So that now the average advanced nation has a debt of something on the order of 100% of GDP. Emerging nations are at about 30, 35, 40%, much lower. So, discipline doesn't mean austerity. Discipline means, in the context of fiscal policy, saving for a rainy day. And how do we know discipline doesn't mean austerity? Or put it another way, that austerity is not the disciplined thing to do at all times? Well, in the book, I talk about the 81 different episodes we have from the emerging world, or the third world, of their experiments with fiscal austerity. It turns out that when inflation is the major issue facing the economy, so think Brazil during the late 1980s, inflation in the 56 episodes that I'm going to talk, 25 episodes of high inflation, we're talking about inflation in excess of 40%, and in many cases as high as 1,000% or more. When inflation is really high and countries implement fiscal austerity, the stock market says this is a really good idea. The stock market goes up by about 100% in real dollar, about 60% in real dollar terms, in anticipation of fiscal austerity, because you need fiscal austerity to cut inflation off. You need to stop printing money to finance your deficit, and you need to bring inflation down so that people can plan their lives. In contrast, in the 56 episodes where emerging economies implemented fiscal austerity, when inflation was not a major issue in the economy, and specifically when inflation was below 40%, the stock market says this is a bad idea. The stock market declines by about 30% in real dollar terms. So the lesson is pretty clear. In the United States and Western Europe, where inflation is 2%, 3% currently, fiscal austerity is not such a good idea. So whether it be Britain or Germany or the rest of Europe, struggling through Germany's attempt to implement a vision of austerity on the rest of the Eurozone, I think the third world lessons are quite clear in the context of discipline. Save when times are good. Fiscal austerity makes sense in high inflation. Otherwise, the focus really should be not on austerity at the moment, but on reform. So let's come to reform. Many different types of reform. But I want to talk briefly about an example from an even smaller country than Chile, the country of Barbados, a country of 250,000 people. And you might ask, what can you possibly learn from a country of 250,000 people? Well, I think we can learn a lot about clarity in leadership. So Barbados, 1992, The country is on the brink of financial ruin. The standard rule of thumb says that a country should have about 3 months' worth of foreign exchange reserves, be able to pay for about 3 months' worth of imports. That's sort of a safe quantity of foreign reserves to have. When the IMF goes to Barbados in 1992, Barbados has about 2 weeks' worth of foreign reserves. So they're on the brink of financial collapse. And the IMF says to Barbados, you need to devalue your currency. So Barbados has a fixed exchange rate vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. It's fixed about 1.7 Barbadian dollars for one U.S. dollar. And the IMF says, your country has become uncompetitive. Your cost of doing business is too high. Wages are too high compared to productivity. Some of this should sound familiar. It's very much the European story outside of Germany, post-euro, being in a fixed exchange rate regime, but not having very rapid increases in productivity. So, what does Barbados do? Barbados actually says to the IMF, no thank you. We agree that we're not a competitive economy. We agree we need to do something. We don't think that devaluing the currency is what we need to do. So the Prime Minister, Erskine Sandiford, convenes three-party talks. The government, private sector employers and owners, and the labor unions. And they sit down for a set of very difficult discussions. And the message is really quite simple. We have to do something. We can't not do anything. We prefer not to devalue. But if we're not going to devalue, we have to do something about our wage structure. Because it's true that we've become an uncompetitive economy. We're having trouble exporting. And when you're a small country and you're heavily dependent on imports, you need to export to earn the foreign exchange to pay for those imports. So the proposal is put on the table to cut wages, in particular public sector wages. Cutting public sector wages and also private sector wages, cutting wage growth, can restore competitiveness and can achieve the same thing as a devaluation. Because it turns out that when countries, the reason why countries and why the IMF recommends to countries that they devalue is because they don't think the governments have the courage to actually have the conversation to bring about wage cuts in the public and private sector. So a devaluation is, in essence, a wage cut without the people's consent. So you can see how that relates to the trust issue, which I'm going to talk about shortly. But right now, the issue is clarity. So they convene these three-party talks. The wage cut is put on the table. And they actually get to a point where a 9% wage cut is proposed. The 9% wage cut, it's decided, is roughly equivalent to the size of the devaluation they would need in order to become competitive again. The problem is, no one likes to have their wages cut. What happens? Protests. Although the government is going to implement this wage cut, people are very unhappy about it, and people take to the streets. 30,000 people take to the streets. It's 1/8 of the population, roughly. 30,000 people march on the capital city of Bridgetown. This is, just to put it in context, that's the equivalent of roughly 80 million people marching on Washington. Okay. This is not a small matter. And to the credit of the head of the labor union, and I talk about this in detail in Chapter 2, Sir Leroy Trotman, he says, no, this is going to tear the country apart. He backs down from his position and begins to sell the wage cut to his constituents. I won't tell you the whole story, but the church has to get involved in it, but somehow Barbados finds a way to get this wage cut through. The employers open up the books to the workers and agree to share future productivity gains, that all future wage increases will be based on productivity gains. So in other words, there'll be shared prosperity. Shared sacrifice now, shared prosperity in the future, because it's what we have to do to save the country. The wage cut holds. stock market responds very positively once there's a tripartite agreement. The economy recovers within a year. And the prime minister, for his troubles, he and his party get kicked out of office for 14 years. But when asked, years later, would you do it again? How do you feel about the way you were treated as a result of getting through this wage cut? The former Prime Minister Erskine Sandiford said, "The price that I paid was a small price to save the country." That's clarity. Last of the three items, trust. Why is trust so critical? I want to talk about it in the context of international relations. I quoted a number of growth figures at the outset of the talk. We need emerging economies to continue to grow at the rates at which they're growing, 5% or more per year. In fact, they're capable of growing even faster if they stay on the discipline path. Again, by the discipline path, I mean implementing reforms, not necessarily all the things that Baker outlined in his speech, because the important thing about discipline is it's country-specific. It's what delivers the most bang for the buck for a given country, given its political constraints, its local culture, and all the various things that have to go into policymaking. But it means thinking about how to harness the market for the good of the people. But we need more of those disciplined reforms so that emerging economies can grow even faster to help pull us along. But the problem is that if we look at the institutions that laid out what discipline means in many respects, the World Bank and the IMF, and take now, go from Chile and Barbados to Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the BRICS, so-called BRICS of the world, they account for 21% of global GDP and have benefited tremendously from the changes that they've made in their economies over the last three decades or so. But yet they only have 11.5% of the votes on critical decisions that are made at the IMF and the World Bank. In contrast, countries of the Eurozone account for 24% of global GDP, 32% of the votes. The United States alone is 17% of the votes of the IMF and the World Bank. This is critical because in order to pass most major decisions at the IMF and the World Bank, you need 85% of the votes. So the United States has effective veto power. So this breeds, as you can imagine, just a little bit of resentment in the developing world, particularly amongst the population. So go back to that speech that was made by Baker in 1985. The United States had in many ways the right message, but the messenger didn't have particularly good bedside manner. And that continues onto today and undermines the ability of leaders who have clarity about what they want to do, the disciplined path that they need to follow to create prosperity for their citizens. These changes are not easy. The changes in Barbados were hard. So you need something to be able to say to your people that there's something in return. Another example of the ways in which our actions in the first world undermine the trust of the third world or the emerging world. At the start of the financial crisis, everyone knew that continued trade, global trade, was going to be key to a quick recovery. And so the advanced nations stood up and said, yes, we are going to do everything we can to support open markets and make sure that global trade, which is the foundation, the cornerstone of prosperity ever since the end of World War II, we're going to reaffirm our commitment to that. Well, between November 2008 and November 2010, according to Global Trade Alert, there were 800 new instances of protectionist measures implemented, over 40% of which were instigated by G8 countries. So again, do as we say, not as we do. Specifically, thinking more generally about trade policy, subsidies from the U.S. government and the European governments, particularly in the case of cotton, $47 billion worth of cotton subsidies since the start of the last Doha development round, which is the latest round of global trade negotiations. Over half of those subsidies went to U.S. cotton farmers. So why does this matter? Well, it's an inefficient use of resources. If U.S. consumers can get cotton more cheaply from cotton growers in places that are struggling to deliver economic development, why shouldn't we get cheaper cotton and use those subsidies to invest in our future? So there are a number of issues like that that undermine the trust of emerging market governments in first world governments, and that, frankly, jeopardize future prosperity. So global, international policies matter, but so do relationships. And good relationships are not a matter of good manners. It's good business. So let me just wrap up because I want to give you a chance to ask questions. First world nations of today resemble, in many ways, third world nations over three decades ago. High debt, slow growth, and a lack of direction. Third world nations, through discipline and clarity, in many instances, have generated the trust of their citizens and turned themselves around and become today's emerging economies that are driving global growth. But in order for us all to have a more prosperous future, to get those growth rates of first world nations back to trend growth rates and above, to reduce unemployment, to get the Miss Mamas of the first world, if you will, back to work, we need, all of us, faster growth here, and just as importantly, faster growth abroad. And in order for that to happen, we need to solve the trust deficit.
Peter Blair Henry, an economist and the author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Peter Blair Henry in just a moment, 844, 94.9 KUOW. North Korean officials continue to warn of nuclear war and have advised foreigners to leave South Korea. A conversation about the North Korean threat tonight at midnight. Lows around 40 tonight for the Seattle area, mostly cloudy, chance of showers this evening. Friday highs near 50 only, mostly cloudy, chance of rain in the afternoon. Gun owners talk about the significance of guns in their lives and their first experience with them. Also, Oregon medical examiner Karen Gunson tells how the leading cause of non-natural deaths she sees in her office are due to gunshot wounds. She is, by the way, a gun owner. Listeners describe their own relationships with firearms. Oregon Public Broadcasting samples the gun owner stories they've collected. And Tom Diaz, author of The Last Gun, tells why after growing up as a gun enthusiast, he now supports strict gun regulation. All this next hour on a special edition of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry. It's all made possible in largest part by listeners like you who make pledges of financial support and, of course, follow through and fulfill those pledges. Take the first step in membership now with a pledge at kuow.org. That's the place to go to make a pledge, and the spring pledge drive is just about over. Let's go out with your pledge at kuow.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Peter Blair Henry is an economist and the dean of NYU's Stern School of Business. He's also the author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He spoke about his book at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19th, 2013. Next, he takes questions from the audience.
I'm wondering about the logistics of actually implementing something like the program in Barbados in the United States. If you could have something in a country of 400 million people that was as inclusive as that, where you have a dialogue with labor unions, you take the problem to the people, and a very, very large group of citizens participates and says, you know what, this is necessary. I'm just wondering about the logistical feasibility of a process like that.
Sure, great question. So let me generalize your question and think about sort of, you know, both Europe and the United States. So the right analog, if you're thinking about the United States, is probably, you know, to think about, you know, sort of think globally, act locally is sort of this. At least when I don't know if people still use that phrase. People use that phrase a lot when I was in college, probably dating myself. But so what does it mean in a local context? Well, I think any set of leaders, whether it be in a state or local context, can learn from that lesson. So I'm not suggesting that we necessarily have a national dialogue about all workers, but I think if local leaders take to heart the story of Barbados and to say, okay, yes, it is possible to get to yes, and there is such a thing as shared sacrifice, and to think about how that might work in their own local circumstance, I think we can make progress. I think, just to generalize to the case of Europe, the reason why I like the story of Barbados so much is not that, you know, it can be directly transferred, because again, you've got to think about local conditions. And in larger countries, there are these logistical issues that are which probably mean thinking about local government as well as national government. But the story of Barbados is exactly the story of Europe in many respects. You know, there was the creation of the Eurozone. Many countries were fixed to the same exchange rate, and then everybody, you know, Germany was a very productive country, implementing a lot of reforms around that time, but nobody else did. And we all knew that Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece were becoming more and more uncompetitive. And so they frankly need less austerity, less fiscal austerity, and more reform, and frankly it's labor market reform, whether it be wage cuts and or getting the country. One thing I didn't mention about Barbados was that not only do employers agree to give wage increases based on productivity, but there's a national dialogue about how to increase productivity in Barbados. And it's really remarkable. I was actually in Barbados 3 years ago when I first started at Stern. A reporter from NPR wanted to look at Barbados versus Jamaica, which is chapter 2 in the book. And so we went to Jamaica and Barbados to see the differences in these two countries. And it was amazing. When you go to Barbados and you're in the hotel, you can have a conversation with the people cleaning your room, and they'll talk to you about productivity. I mean, they've driven that message into the fabric of the society. And people understand that as a small country, in order for us to compete, we've got to be productive. So I do think it's possible, but I think the right analog is to think about it in a local context.
Okay, cool. And sorry, I did have a second question. Is that allowed?
Yes, and I'll give a shorter answer to the second one.
So you're counting the BRIC countries as emerging, right? China has not emerged yet.
Correct.
Okay. So when I think China, I do not think clarity. And maybe that's because I'm synonymizing clarity with transparency, but I think of hundreds of pigs that just kind of mysteriously appeared in the river earlier this week. And I think of, you know, no, there is no cyber war, and no, we haven't looked at your Google account anytime recently. So maybe that's political clarity, which is something different. But I was just hoping that you could speak a little bit to the case of China. And
absolutely.
It seems to me.
Absolutely. So the three principles that I mentioned, the extent to which they applied varies across the country. And I think the key thing in China is understanding what discipline means. Okay. But again, I'm going to go back to my story. Discipline doesn't mean what you think it means. It doesn't mean extreme measures. That's not the sense in which China was disciplined in my reading of the history of China's economic reform. China was pragmatic. When Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978, he had this famous quote where he said, and he was referring to, you know, what came to be known as Chinese socialism with Chinese characteristics, meaning we're going to have a market economy. Deng said, I don't care if the cat is black or white. I don't care whether we're talking about capitalism or communism. I want a cat that catches mice. And so he made room in the party for people to experiment with everything from moving from collectivism in agriculture to small-scale experiments with letting people own the land and keep part of their produce and selling it. And lots of small-scale experiments that use the Chinese proverb, crossing the river of capitalism one stone at a time. I think that's the key lesson from China. And China clearly has lots and lots of challenges, which I wouldn't minimize. But I think it's also important, since you mentioned China, to also recognize that there are many stories of turnaround that actually occur in large, complicated democracies. You know, Brazil being a multi-ethnic democracy. And a story which, you know, is still ongoing. Indonesia is a country that was a basket case in 1997 during the Asian crisis under Suharto. Was an autocracy. Is now a fledgling democracy, but a democracy, managing its natural resources in ways that we typically don't see. So I'm glad that you mentioned China, because I think that the key lesson from China is pragmatism in the context of discipline. But important to remember, there are democracies that manage to deliver good economic policy, which I think should be a message that we need to learn. This can be done. Thanks for your questions.
My question has to do with income inequity. Mm-hmm. When I look at income inequity, and it's gotten much worse in the United States over the last decade, and for probably even a period longer than that, I also look at income inequity around the world, and I don't know that it's getting any better. So what you have is, on a global scale, you've got all of these companies that don't have to really pay any attention to particular governments in particular countries and can play governments off against each other. And you know, so I appreciate you worrying about global growth, but my big thing is, where do we have the stick to control these global businesses that are driving the democracy out of America? And since America has been a standard for what is good democracy, I think other countries don't trust us anymore because they don't believe we know how to do democracy any longer. Plus, we've got greater and greater income inequity, and I don't see in your model like how Barbados, you know, really solves that. It's great to look at, you know, all politics is local, but I'm sorry, I don't believe that Barbados is really controlled by the local scene as much as it's controlled by these huge corporate entities, business entities, that are running our world and destroying democracy. So I need you to address the income inequity in your scheme here.
Yeah, so there's a lot in your question. I won't try to take all of it. I think you raise a very important point, which is that companies large corporations can have outsized influence in policy, and I think it's increasingly important for future global leaders, largely in corporations, to recognize this fact and recognize that the countries are as important a stakeholder as their local shareholders. And taking a responsible, or if you will, disciplined view of what that means, I think is going to be critical to delivering sustainable value for corporations. Right? So in other words, if I'm a company and I'm, you know, doing business in Nigeria or Indonesia, and I'm doing things that are, you know, good for sort of 2-year, 4-year returns, but are ultimately undermining things 10, 15 years down the road, that's not sustainable, and that's not good business. So, to put on my Stern School hat for a minute, we've recognized this. I mean, one of the things that we're doing specifically, and we just hired a brand new faculty member who's come to us from the State Department. Assistant Secretary of State Michael Posner has joined the Stern School faculty because he wants to teach at a business school. Because in his work at the State Department last year, he sees exactly the issues that you raised, that there's a dialogue between corporations and countries that isn't what it should be. And the only way to create a better dialogue is to create better leaders who are going to be driving that dialogue. So I selfishly, and you know, kind of wearing my stern hat, saying, we're working really hard to change that conversation. I'll just say that I think that, you know, there still are very important, some of the lessons, if you will, that those future leaders need to learn, I think do come from looking at, in some cases, big countries like Brazil, but in some cases, small countries like Barbados. Let me take the income inequality question and narrow it down just a little bit. So I think in the context of the United States, there's a lot of discussion of income inequality, and we know that the middle class and the working class in particular in this country hasn't done well in the last decade, putting it mildly. I think we need to be disciplined in that discussion as well, because there's sort of this knee-jerk reaction to say, well, income inequality is all about the tax system. As I talk about in turnaround, changing who pays what in order to put our fiscal house back on a sustainable path is an important question, and we could have an honest debate about, you know, raising taxes on the 1%. It's an important part of an overall discussion about fiscal sustainability, but really it's actually very little to do with income inequality. The things that really drive income inequality in this country are the fact that we don't use our resources efficiently to invest in education. And the best way to reduce income inequality is to produce more high-skilled workers. So the way you typically measure income inequality is to look at the gap between the average wage of a high-schooled educated worker versus a college-educated worker. And we know that gap is growing. It's growing because, you know, think of this wonderful city. If you've got a Stern graduate degree or a degree from the University of Washington, you can do really well in this world. And with the constant rate of technological change, the returns to being a highly skilled college-educated, graduate-educated individual are continuing to grow at a really rapid rate. And if you only have a high school education, you're in a tough situation. And so the way to close that gap is to produce more college graduates. More skilled people. Because it doesn't necessarily mean a college education. There are many ways to be skilled. More numerate, literate, analytical people who can take advantage of the knowledge economy. That'll do two things. It'll increase the supply of high-skilled workers, which means it'll start to shrink the wage gap, because the highly skilled people will be less scarce. So the wages won't go up as quickly, but also increase the number of people who are actually getting high wages. So fundamentally, there's no getting away from education to deal with the problem of income inequality. So I think that's really where the issue is in this country. So I hope I've answered your question at least partially.
Peter Blair Henry, an economist and the author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Cameron Drews recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the retina doctors at Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, currently enrolling patients in a clinical trial testing an investigational drug to treat dry age-related.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.